Shalom, shalom, friends. It's wonderful to see you. That is a nigun from V'Samecha Bechagecha. We should be joyful on the holiday period with Purim coming this weekend, this Saturday night and Sunday. So it's great to be with you all. Mourning today the passing of a cousin. His name was Byron Yanis, if you've ever heard of him, one of the most famous pianists of the 20th century. I never personally met him, but he was a great, brilliant pianist, and he also took a stand and didn't play in Alabama during Wallace's segregation. And his original name was Yanks, and before that was Yankelovich, and his father's name was Shmuley Yankelovich, so of a Polish immigrant. So there was a first and real Shmuley Yankelevich before you got this imposter. So we'll learn in his memory today, in addition to other people that have passed recently that we're mourning. And I am both, it's bittersweet that this is the 45th and final of this series for 45th session. Many of you have been at all of them, or almost all of them. And so thank you for that. It's really been a delight, and we could have done hundreds more. We're only scratching the surface. And I do hope you'll stay with us. We've got this 10-part series starting next Tuesday at the same time. The 10 greatest Jewish ideas offered to the world. As always, it's an exploration of ideas, but it's also a conversation. It's a community. It's a place of us connecting and sharing ideas. And we just got word this morning that Reform Congregation in Canton, Ohio registered to join us. So there's going to be like a group in the room from Canton, Ohio. So that'll be fun to be with them. There's no magic as to who our last philosopher is today. There could have been many different choices. Part of the goal was to have a diversity of thought. And part of it was, as we got into the 20th century, 21st century, to have some diversity of representation with people of color and with women and, different types of ideas. And so none of these represent the best or my favorites. They're just kind of a, I mean, obviously in the beginning, when you're dealing with Socrates, Plato, or later with Kant and Hegel and Hume, I mean, some of these are just classics. And then it gets relatively arbitrary who you bring in and who you don't. So Kwame Appiah, you might be familiar with his name because I think he still does. For years now, he's been the ethicist at the New York Times. That's not to say that he's guiding the New York Times on their ethics. That's to say that there's a column, or whatever you call it, some section where people write in questions, and he's the philosopher who responds to these ethical dilemmas. And if you look through those, you can see if you find his answers compelling or not. But let's jump a little bit into him. And at some point, we're gonna hear a brief clip of one of my interviews with him as well, like we did with Peter Singer and like we did with Martha Nussbaum. I think those are the only three who are living still that we're doing. So those are the three we have interviews with. In any case, with Kant or Aristotle. Before we jump in, though, we got a poll question with that relevant to Appiah. So let's see what we got here. I realized that he's turning 70 this year, or already did, given that he was born in 54. Okay, we've got a poll question. A primary orientation. Jews should primarily be universalists, i.e., caring for all humanity. Option one. Option two, Jews should primarily be particularists, caring for the Jewish community. Option three, Jews can easily combine being universalists and particularists without losing much. Okay, again, option one, Jews should primarily be universalists. Option two, Jews should primarily take care of Jews, particularists. And option three, really, it's not so hard to combine these two without losing much. Okay, 100%. That fits in with our VBM model. Our VBM model is that Jewish learning, in all of its particularist sense, should move us to being universalists in addition to being particularists, and that we lose nothing by standing up for Jewish security and standing up for Israel while also combating homelessness and hate wherever we see it, that these two sides strengthen each other. Now we're going to get into a little more nuance on this approach with Appiah. With Kant or Aristotle or Plato or most of the philosophers we're discussing, you and I can read their writings and learn from what experts have written about their philosophies. But except maybe in a dream, we don't get to ask questions or talk with them directly. Today, on the other hand, we are going to be talking about the philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah. And I had the privilege and pleasure of emailing and talking with Professor Appiah on several occasions. You can watch two of my recorded conversations with him online, and I encourage you to read his books. And as I said, we'll look at one of his interviews here. Professor Kwame Appiah was born in the UK of British and Ghanaian parents, descended of politicians and people of status from both lands. Professor Appiah grew up primarily in Ghana, though also spending much time in England, and currently lives as a naturalized American citizen in New York City. He's a professor of philosophy and law in the Department of Philosophy at NYU, and he researches and writes about ethics, race, and political philosophy, among other topics. Professor Appiah has written of his particular experiences growing up gay in post-colonial Ghana. He writes for popular as well as academic audiences and has written the Ethicist column in the New York Times for the past 8 years. He has a real role as a contemporary public intellectual, very different from Singer, although also a public intellectual who writes in major outlets like that. Professor Appiah situates himself within the philosophical tradition of cosmopolitanism. In his book called Cosmopolitanism, he traces the term back to the cynics of the 4th century of Common Era with the paradoxical definition, citizen of the cosmos. And he marks the influence this notion of universalism had in the development of the Christian church and Enlightenment liberalism, and how cosmopolitanism has been reviled by nationalist movements of the 20th century. Nationalists, you make your people, your tribe, your nation primary, as opposed to a universalistic approach that has some notion of the welfare and unity of the collective unity of humanity. Appiah describes his own conception of cosmopolitanism like this. So there's two strands that intertwine in the notion of cosmopolitanism. One is the idea that we have obligations to others, obligations that stretch beyond those to whom we are related by the ties of kin, kith and kin, or even the more formal ties of a shared citizenship. The other is that we take seriously the value not just of human life, but of particular human lives, which means taking an interest in the practices and beliefs that lend them significance. People are different, the cosmopolitan knows, and there's much to learn from our differences. Because there are so many human possibilities worth exploring, we neither expect nor desire that every person or every society should converge on a single mode of life. Whatever our obligations are to others or theirs to us, they often have the right to go their own way. As we'll see, there will be times when these two ideals, universal concern and respect for legitimate difference, clash. There's a sense in which cosmopolitanism is the name not of the solution, but of the challenge, right? How do we find commonality, but also celebrate difference? He establishes a tension between a universalist morality that considers all humans equally responsible for one another and a belief that humans are diverse and different from one another, even in their values, their lifestyles, their moral systems. He does not deny that these two underlying assumptions about the simultaneous sameness and difference of humans in terms of their morality can come into conflict. But he attempts to show that they both derive from the same deeper belief in the value of diversity, which finds expression in the commitment that the individual must have freedom to diverge and choose one's own way. For this same reason, we must also dedicate ourselves to exploring and learning from many different attempts to gain wisdom. Appiah understands cosmopolitanism as a moral obligation and also in terms of the character trait of curiosity. Though these two aspects are related, he teaches that curiosity and learning about other cultures certainly does not guarantee someone will treat people who are different from them ethically or with dignity. Though Appiah emphasizes human freedom, he's not a relativist. For example, when I asked Professor Appiah about the benefits and drawbacks of using European intellectual produce to address global issues, he responded, "My views about theories is that the question to ask about them isn't who invented them or where they come from, but whether they are any good." He believes that ideas can be evaluated for their morality and truth using reason and then applied in other cultural contexts. He's practical, though, in pointing out that reasoning one's way to truth in the abstract is not a direct route to actual progress in society. And he teaches that the transfer of ideas between cultures must be a relational process and not one-sided. Every culture has something to teach, and every culture has something to learn. When I asked him about how American activists can serve as allies to gay Ghanaians suffering from government repression, he first contextualized the situation in Ghana for me. And then he said, "We should, quote, be clear to Ghanaian politicians that we do think they have a responsibility to bring their country into compliance for human rights norms. I think we should just have this conversation because I want them to be able to tell us what they think we're doing wrong." For Appiah, non-coercive dialogue, curiosity, openness, and relationship are important, right? So he's saying, okay, as an American gay rights activist, you don't just yell at the Ghanaian government for repressing gay rights. It's actually an educational dialogue. He himself, being a gay Ghanaian, doesn't just want to scream at them for their human rights violations. He wants to understand them, and he wants them to listen to him. He really believes both sides can learn from each other. It's not just that allies and homophobes. It's actually different cultures and that can learn from each other. Respect and dignity are important. In his book, In My Father's House, Africa and the Philosophy of Culture, Professor Appiah explores questions of race, identity, and social movements. He argues against racialism, the belief that humanity is divided into different races, and that members of a given race share traits and tendencies deeper and more essential than physical appearance, which they do not share with members of other races. For Appiah, the idea of race and the notion of different biological races with different essential characteristics is provably false, an artificial construct that is not scientifically accurate and is better understood as pseudoscience. That, of course, would get him in trouble with certain types of Black ideologies and certain types of white ideologies, those who feel race is something essential to who they are. Right? I am fundamentally different as a Black woman. I'm fundamentally different as a white man, right? This is beyond my skin color. According to Appiah, racism takes on two forms, one extrinsic and the other intrinsic. Extrinsic racism, according to Appiah, is an ethical system that depends on racialist assumptions. It assumes that the essential differences between the races are reasons to consider people of different races differently in moral decision-making. For example, assuming Black people are more likely to be criminals and therefore treating them more harshly than white people in the criminal justice system. Intrinsic racism, on the other hand, does not seek to divide up the world into a hierarchy of races, but is instead founded on the notion that one should treat members of one's own race differently than members of other races. Like a non-universalist ethical system that requires one to act differently to one's own family than to a stranger, the intrinsic racist believes in treating members of another race differently, whether or not people of the different races have different characteristics. Appiah says that these three ways of thinking, racialism, intrinsic and extrinsic racism, are certainly often related to one another and hard to pull apart in particular cases. But that it is useful to keep their separate definitions in mind. So take that last case. You might say, for example, someone who says, "Oh, shop at this store because it's owned by a Black man." right? That that would be problematic. So two, hiring somebody because of an affinity towards their whiteness, right, as opposed to someone of color would be a problem, right? Giving special treatment to someone because of their race, right? Even if you think it's in an, an affirmative action sense, although that gets a little more complicated, becomes an issue. And it reinforces the very problem of essentialism. As mentioned, his view is that race is not real. It is an invented concept and not a useful one, indeed a damaging one for understanding humanity. But he still finds it worthwhile to understand the construct of race and the way it influences people's moral systems. Right? To be sure, this is different than someone saying that they're colorblind, like I actually don't see race. He is saying race is a construct and it is an invented concept that is not useful, but it is slightly different than that other type of argument. Professor Appiah brings different examples to illustrate these ideas, but his primary case study in My Father's House is Pan-Africanism. He discusses in depth the theory of Pan-Africanism that W.E.B. Du Bois developed over the course of his long life, which is based on a notion that there are different human races, each with their own gift and mission to bring to humanity. Du Bois therefore called on the race of Africans, including African Americans, to become unified in order to discover and fully realize their role in human civilization. According to Appiah's analysis, Du Bois' theory suffers from a lack of coherent definition of race. In rejecting pseudoscientific notions of racial inferiority, Du Bois also justly rejects the notion of a biological definition of race. But at the same time, he cannot escape it entirely, for the other groundings he attempts to give race, socio-historical, linguistic, geographic, and even notions of shared historical oppression, each fail to provide an internally consistent concept of race that can serve Du Bois's purposes. According to Appiah, Du Bois lived the end of his life in Ghana, driven by a hope for a sense of home that he could not find in racist America, but was ultimately unsuccessful in being able to construct the theory of race would support that dream. Appiah further teaches that the notion of race is an invention of the West that has nevertheless made its way into post-colonial African ideologies. In dismissing theories of humanity based on race as not true to reality, Appiah offers us instead to see a post-essentialist world in which people have more in common than we might otherwise imagine. He also invites us to embrace a diversity of identity that encompasses more than just race. He cares deeply about culture and seeing overlapping identity variables like gender, socioeconomic status, and nationality that shouldn't be oversimplified, right? We can't divide the world into white, brown, and black people. That just oversimplifies the entirety of what makes us human. He further explores these ideas in his book, The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. Professor Appiah's work exploring questions of individual and group identity in relation to other groups and in relation to global humanity is particularly relevant to thinking about the Jewish experience in the world. He himself frequently refers to Jewish history, for example, stating in the introduction to his book, Cosmopolitanism, that when Hitler and Stalin vilified rootless cosmopolitans, it was often just a euphemism for anti-Semitism. Because local Jewish communities are vitally connected to a wider global community of Jews that transcended national borders, nationalists often saw them as embodying the ideas of cosmopolitanism. Also, in Appiah's discussion of race and identity in My Father's House, he explores historical examples, the Jewish people's racialized oppression, as well as showing how Pan-Africanism to Zionism developed in parallel in the 19th century. Fascinating how Pan-Africanism and Zionism developed in parallel in the 19th century. One Jewish thinker I believe is particularly worthwhile to think about in dialogue with Professor Appiah is Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory. Like Appiah, Sacks established himself as a public intellectual, writing and speaking about large and deep ideas for popular audiences. Rabbi Sacks was simultaneously a universalist and a particularist, in a way reminiscent of Appiah's cosmopolitan framework. Sacks celebrated human solidarity, unity, and equality, while also putting great emphasis on the particulars of different cultures. He demanded the world see him not just as a human, but also as a religious Jew. And he said that all human beings should be seen for their uniqueness as well. We should honor the other, teaches Sacks, because of the ways in which they are different from us and in spite of them. Appiah puts more emphasis on the nuance of identity, that diversity exists in a way that is too complex to separate people neatly into groups, right? People politically like to put people in boxes. But both argue for tolerance and dialogue, and neither are moral relativists. In today, friends, to conclude here, much to discuss together, in today's globally interconnected world, Appiah and Sacks both speak to some of the greatest tensions of our time. The tension between tribalism, the idea that my group is superior to all others and all others are inferior, and an absolute universalism that wants to abandon or eliminate historical particularities and differences. We see this tension in the wide world, and we see it in the Jewish world. Appiah and Sacks invite us to live within the nuance of holding both ideals of particular diversity and universal humanity. Friends, before we go open up our conversation, I want to just play a minute or two of a conversation with Professor Appiah.
What are some benefits and drawbacks for using epistemologies developed in Europe and the United States to address issues that are global in nature?
You know, my own view about theories, about philosophies, about epistemologies is that the question to ask about them isn't who invented them or where they come from, but whether they're any good. And so the main advantage and disadvantage of using Western epistemologies is that some of them are good and some of them are bad. I think we gain a lot by paying attention as well to ideas from other parts of the world. We're on spring break this week, but next Monday I will continue a course I'm teaching in global ethics, and that course has included looking at Muslim materials and Confucian materials, as well as familiar sort of materials out of European liberal traditions. And I think you learn things by looking at things from a variety of angles. The reason why using ideas that have sort of come out of the West, come out of Europe, come out of North America, you know, one problem with them is that in some places they're regarded with suspicion, and maybe there's some of those suspicions are justified, but I think the right thing to do if you're suspicious about a way of thinking is to make arguments, to explain what's wrong with it, not to discuss where it came from, which is basically a kind of cultural argumentum ad hominem. It's just a way of complaining about something because of the person who's saying it, rather than complaining about the content of what's being said. So I feel I've learned a lot.
Wonderful. So I think that's a perfect clip to end with him on, because I think it's relevant to what we're doing in this series altogether. I know there are some who believe strongly that we care about where ideas come from, and there is something to say for that. But I think part of what we've tried to do in this series together is say, you know what? It doesn't matter if a great idea came from a Christian theologian or a Muslim philosopher or from an anti-Semite or a racist. Like, it partially matters. But what partially matters is that we seek truth. And people we disagree with theologically and morally, and sometimes even repugnant people, can have ideas of merit. If you could be one of the best musicians in the world and be filled with hate, you can be an incredible philosopher and be very insightful. And so we do partially care. Like, I'm not so interested in spending my time with racists and anti-Semites, you know, and learning from them. But throughout history, when it's anachronistic, ideas that we cherish today were understood very differently 100 years ago, not to mention 2,000 years ago. We would shut off the entirety of the world if we stopped learning from people who held views we view as repugnant. And so part of what Appiah is saying is that we should continue to mine history and mine all cultural traditions for their wisdom, even when we might disagree with so much. And I think that that really is at the heart of Jewish intellectualism, that we don't just say, oh, we only look at a narrow group of Jewish ideas, but we want to learn from every person, as Ben Zoma says in Pirkei Avot, that, that a wise person is someone who learns from everyone. And my hope is that in this series, we're just kind of flexing the muscle, exercising the muscle, I should say, of being able to read any person, being able to learn from every tradition in some way that is not relativistic, saying it's all the same, but being able to find insights. And I think that ought to be true as well politically, right? I know people who will only read out of one newspaper or only listen to people of their political party. You know, they just dismiss other people. Like, is it really that hard to read someone where you disagree with 75% of what they say, but actually find some interest in 25%? And I think that, you know, that can be true. And I think that's actually not only important for Jewish intellectual development, I think it's also true for healing a society, that we can learn from different religions, we can learn from different political persuasions, we can learn from people of different orientations rather than just putting people in a box and learning from a narrow group. All right, friends, so I want to open the conversation. We've got a half hour left in this last session. Anything on Appiah or things that he raised or more broadly on some of the stuff we've kind of explored together? I'd love to hear from you. Hi, Aglaia.
I'm kind of pressed for time, so that's why I jumped in first.
Okay, great.
First off, I actually have criticized the boys also. I actually criticized them in front of a bunch of undergrads and everything like that, though, but it was a completely different, you know, context and everything. I don't want to say this. It's not going to be comfortable discussion topic. Trust me, no one in this Zoom meeting is more uncomfortable than I am right now, okay? Because it's not easy for me. Okay, so here's my question. I am a Jewish woman, and I am also a woman of color. When it comes to particularism, you know, and Jewish particularism and everything like that, okay, so where do people like me fit in? Sorry, forgive me.
No, my gosh, no, forgive you for what? Thank you. Well, do you want to try to answer your question before any of us engage with it?
Okay, it's really not easy for me to talk about this, okay? But the short version of the story is, though, is that when it comes to, I mean, does particularism also include what it's like for me to be a woman of color? Does particularism include also what it's like for a gay Jew, what it's like for them to be gay, or any of the above? One of the questions that I've actually like, you know, like in a, just a philosophical discussion with, you know, hypotheticals and everything, I've talked to people about passing. Now, believe me, being a passant blanc was part of my family history. Okay, short version of that story. Okay, so there's no judgment or anything like that, though, about any of that kind of stuff. But here was what the was discussed. If I walked in with her to a majority black setting, to be honest, I can't even fit in there. However, though, with hypothetically, I could blend in. And someone there started giving, you know, that person hell about being Jewish and starting saying all kinds of anti-Semitic stuff. What would she think of me if I said, if I didn't tell them? If I didn't tell them that I'm Jewish too. Now, take it. It's not the same thing. And like I said, I don't judge because of this issue. However, though, it's just, it's also, like I said, it's not the same thing because I'm giving up, I would give up my ability to blend in that one setting. A lot of people, I would be asking them to give up what it's like, you know, in mainstream society. So it's like giving up $10,000 versus giving up millions. So it's not the same thing. However, though, it's not Jewish people and they're not Jewish people and people of color and gay people and so on and so forth. So in the passing situation, are you turning your back on your own? I would be turning my back on my own if I did that to a Jewish person, a white Jewish person who walked into that setting with me. And I would not be able to respect myself for that. So just that's something that, you know, to throw out there. So.
Awesome, Aglaya. I'm so glad you did. I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you so much. And I think that that's such a great conversation into the various layers of our particularism. That on the one hand, we want to say every human being is totally unique in the world. There's no human like me and like you, right? God makes every person totally different. And yet there's a collective that we're all united. And then there's dozens of layers between every person being unique and every person being the same. And that bridge between particularism and universalism is not just Jewish or Muslim or American, right? There's so many layers to that, right? Someone might say, hey, I'm not just in the LGBTQ community. I'm uniquely a lesbian. Being a lesbian is a unique part of my particularism in addition to that level of particularism. Someone might say, hey, I'm not just a Muslim. I'm Sufi. Right? I'm not just a Jew, I'm proudly Ashkenazi or Sephardic, or I'm Reform, and like Reform is a different layer of my particularism, or I'm Orthodox, right? And to be sure, like we can't assume that people want to publicly identify with different nuances of particularism unless they identify as such. I know many Jews of color who do not want to be a part of a Jew of color movement, don't want to be called a Jew of color, they just want to be a Jew. Treat me as a Jew. That is my sole particularism. I am not a Jew of color. Just like I know many gay Jews who don't want to be identified as gay. It's not that they're not proud of it. They just want to be a Jew. And I know others who being in the JOC community is like essential to their Jewish identity. The particularism of saying, hey, I'm not just a Jew, I'm a Jew of color, or I'm not just a Jew, I'm a gay Jew, right? That actually is crucial to their particularism. And I think that's such an important conversation you're bringing up because, you know, we sometimes assume that there's just one bucket of being a Jew and that represents particularism in its fullness. And for some, it does. I know some people that like what they fundamentally are is just Jew, period, full stop, right? And I know others that are going to have a bunch of other adjectives or nouns that kind of go along with that. And that feels like a crucial part of what it looks like to build inclusive community today is to foster conversations like that. And again, we can't impose it on people. I've seen many people who don't want that. They don't want to be labeled with a denomination. I'm Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, be labeled with a race or a sexual orientation or the like. Or Ashkenazic or Sephardic, whatever the case is, and others who really do. And so it feels like a really important thing to ask about and cultivate nuance around. Same with a convert. I know many people who want to wear the badge of honor of being a convert. I'm not just a Jew. I'm a Jew who converted. I know other people who want that to be deeply private. And want to say, hey, I'm just a Jew. How dare you say I converted? That's my own private business, right? And again, very different orientations of particularism. And Cynthia Ozick, we mentioned this some year or two so ago, when she talked about the shofar, she said, if you try to blow the shofar from the wide side, you can't make a sound. But if you blow it from the narrow side, you can make a sound, which is to say you have to achieve your universalism through your particularism. Right, you blow through the narrow side of the shofar, and the more nuanced we can get on the type of human I am, if to some degree, and again, some people hate labels. Say, don't label me. I'm just a human being, right? I'm just a Jew. And other people love labels. I'm this kind of human and this kind of Jew and this kind of blah blah blah. And we don't pass judgment on that. So Aglaya, thank you so much for opening that up, and you know, hopefully we'll hear more from you as well. Hey, Gary.
I can appreciate what you said, Rabbi, and I appreciate what you said, Aglaya. My issue is these are artificial labels that we put on people and things. And it, to me, it just creates a bigger issue of this particularism, and it creates more divisiveness. In some regards, I consider particularism as a whole no different than racism. You know, why can't we just look at people as human beings and accept who they are, rather than try throwing people into buckets or boxes, as you say. To me, that creates a bigger issue. It's just another way of, for lack of better terms, racism. We try to peg people who they are, what they are, rather than human beings. And that just really, really, really bothers me that we continue to do this. And it's created difficulties in humanity. And I try to fight against that. Selo Elohim, we are created in God's image. And yes, we are all different, but yet we're all the same. And that's what I fight for. It doesn't matter to me if you're a Jew by choice, or if you're a Jew by birth, or if you're gay, or whatever. It doesn't make any difference. You're a human being, and we should learn to accept each other for who we are, rather than how putting a tag on people. So
Gary, just to follow up with you there. Yeah. So, I mean, I think few think that things like taxation ought to be in any way linked to race, right? Like Black people should, because of race, pay less tax than a white person. Now, bracketing the conversation of slave reparations, which many actually would attach to race, since the lineage is not always easy to connect. But it sounds like in something like affirmative action, it sounds like you would disagree with the mainstream liberal position, right? That people of color should have more opportunity, be given more opportunity educationally. Right, that race should not be a factor in policy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's a political view. That's my issue. Is that we have politics, and then we have humanity, and it seems to me that race was just another way dating way back when, for people of class, typically white people, made themselves feel better than people from deep, darkest part of Africa or South America or people of color. So it was something that was fabricated to make people of, white people feel better. So my idea was that if there was a issue such as slavery, then yes, there has to be some type of, to move forward, we have to recognize there was an injustice. And so we can move forward. And how do we pay forward that injustice? My grandparents were in Europe. They weren't in America during slavery. But as an American, and I buy into American history, for example, we have to undo that injustice that has created a situation of hatred and injustice for African Americans, just like during World War II with the Japanese, when we took Americans took everything away from Japanese Americans and put them in camps, basically. And sooner down the road, we finally decided that was wrong, and we had to make reparations. So to undo that injustice. So I have a hard time dealing with the political end of it compared to the humanitarian.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. So on the one hand, we know that people want to be seen in their fullness. They want to be seen in their uniqueness, in their particularities. On the other hand, I hear you saying that when it comes to what's just, we need to remove these ideas that you would view as racist because they divide us up and make us kind of, superior or inferior in a sense. Okay, so very interesting. I'm glad you weighed in.
Well, can I, while nobody's judging, can we just say a comment to Aglaia? I'm not saying what you feel is important, because all of our feelings are important. And I hope that you find a situation where you feel comfortable. But I think all of us individually have something to bring to the table, despite where we were raised or how we were raised and what cultures we were raised with. We all bring something to the table. And I think we don't always recognize that. Once I was said, this country is like a salad, each item we put into a salad adds to the value of the dish. And unfortunately, we've become so divided that we don't see that anymore.
May I respond? That's one of the reasons why I assign Voltaire, to be honest. I've assigned Voltaire. I've assigned Rousseau. I mean, I've, you know, assigned Karl Marx. I mean, just, I mean, it's not that, I mean, for me, I mean, the fact that these people were, you know, the people they were and everything, though, for lack of the word I want to use, but anyway, though, that the, I mean, who isn't? That's one of the reasons why I believe all of us are screwed up in some way or another. And so because of that, though, the way that I look at it is also to go the Maimonides route. Everyone's doing teshuva all of the time for all of this kind of stuff. And so because of that, though, like, you know, say, for instance, you know, I'm sure Voltaire, whatever, wherever he is right now and everything like that, has had to learn a few lessons, but probably he got more wrong than I even realize and whatever. But the thing is that, yeah, I'll assign him. I'll assign, you know, a lot of stuff and everything, though, because it's not all, he wasn't just an anti-Semite. He wasn't just a racist. I really honestly don't see heroes and villains necessarily, because, I mean, there are some kind of like, okay, that was a little sus. But the thing is that doesn't mean that just because you were sus doesn't mean that you were all only sus. And just because you were supposedly good doesn't mean that you weren't a little sus in your own way. So,
by the way, for those, correct me if I'm wrong, but for those over 60, and I include myself in that category, given my own affiliations, I think sus means suspect, right? When she says, oh, that's a little sus.
It's okay. I work with younger people all of the time. So I took some of them.
Okay. I just wanted to translate here because I've never used the word sus before, but I think my kids have used it. And so I figured some others might have been confused, like myself, like a month ago. Thank you. That's a great point. So, all right, before we go to our next person who'd like to speak, I just want to prepare folks that the last question I'm going to ask you today is whether you want to put it in the chat or share it. Is who one thinker out of our 45 were that really resonates for you? Someone you might want to go back and read directly or learn more about. Some of you are students of philosophy and some of you, this is all a little bit new, but was there one idea or one thinker in all of this that you feel like, oh, that was something like that really resonated for me? And again, this, you're not going to go down to the grave with this. It's not going to say on your tombstone, like student of Socrates or lover of Wollstonecraft. It's just a sharing at the end of a Zoom. So if anybody wants to share that, that's also welcome towards the end here or whenever you want. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Matthew, hi.
This is just a commentary on time. And I'm thinking, Lee, about what you spoke about. And a friend of mine in college, in the 60s, who remarked there were only 5 women he could date in the United States because he had no choices. He was upper class black from Chicago, very wealthy family, whose grandfather had converted to Judaism to become a rabbi, and the family was Orthodox. So the idea of convert that he was third generation was unacceptable to my grandfather, the Orthodox rabbi, and he knew every black woman who fit in that category in America.
Right.
So there were no choices. So what did he do? He married a philosopher from Ethiopia. And he's a very famous lawyer who mentored significant politicians from Chicago, went on to national office. But he talked about the constraints he had growing up, fitting in nowhere, saying, like, in a black community, do I say I'm Jewish? Walking to a Jewish community, said I could out-daven anyone in a reform or conservative school because I learned. But I didn't fit in, and he found his own way to do things. This was in the mid-60s. So it's a different world. The idea of saying Jew, color, gay, etc. Those weren't choices more than 50 years ago. We're talking, close to 60 years, maybe 55 years ago. Just an interesting commentary on how society has changed, but it hasn't changed. That's all I'm going to say.
Great, Matthew. Yeah, thank you for that. It is very interesting. And I find hilarious that phrase, out-daven anyone. Right? As if like there's like some competitive prayer landscape. But I totally get the point. And yeah, and I think that sometimes we do forget.
By the way, his reference to out-daven, not to prayer, but in terms of studying and knowledge compared to a reform. Yeah. Jew of the 50s and 60s who knew nothing about their heritage. He had studied Talmud. Yeah.
Right, exactly, right. Yes, this is a really important point. And we have lost, this is not your point, but we have lost our ability to help people find matches in the world because it really is hard to find a match based on so many factors of age and wealth and race and religious orientation. And many people, as you say, do feel more limited than others for various reasons. And of course, there's really poor-tasted ways to do that, of just throwing two random people together. You're Black Jew and you're a Black Jew, or 80 and you're 80, you should get together. Right? As if being 80 means you're a good match, or as if being Black means you're a good match, right? It's like absurd. So like it does take a lot of nuance and people shouldn't just jump into it. But yeah, there are people really struggling to find partners, and we ought to find ways to support them. Hi, Sarah. I think you're about to jump in, Sarah.
I was thinking that tribalism has always been a struggle for me, that identifying in tribal ideology, I'm othering the other. And for me, that's deeply uncomfortable. In fact, my tendency then is to embrace the other because it is the other. It's what is not me that I am curious about, that I want to know more about, that I want to share with. And as I thought more deeply about it, and when we raised the question of who can we partner with, it's like, okay, I do have a tribalism. It's a liberalism that I recognize is my tribe, that I am a progressive, I am a liberal, I embrace justice and social welfare and all sorts of things that matter to me, that are my values, that don't fit into the tribes that we're necessarily talking about, but are clearly my tribe. I would not go out and find myself a Trumpian to become my BFF. Just, it ain't gonna happen. And it doesn't mean that I can't try to converse with that human being and try to see their humanity, if there is any, but that's not my tribe. So as far as, I don't see my Ashkenazic Jewish background as being my tribe. I remember as a kid, the first airlifts from Ethiopia of Falashian Jews, I was so excited. It's like, we're not all these white people, thank God. And I guess I'm also blessed because my congregation is headed by a beautiful Korean American rabbi cantor. And you know, we have a number of LGBT clergy. Our clergy is diverse and embracing, and it's a loving, wonderful community that helps me remember all the time that Jews can be diverse. It's our fear that keeps us confined to what we see as our little tribe. And I'm complete. Oh, and okay. I'll keep reading Peter Singer because he's helping me with my philanthropy. Thank you.
Oh, okay, great. Awesome. Very cool. My colleague who is a chassid of Peter Singer's, I'll let him know someone said that. He'll be very happy. So on the one hand, I think what you also just made is, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is the reason why intermarriage has become so acceptable, which is that people say my tribe is liberalism. My tribe is not fundamentally of a Jewish orientation. And so I have more in common with a secular or non-Jewish fellow liberal who shares the exact same values of me than I do the person who's going to go to synagogue with me. Now, you're more involved, of course, but then gonna like me go to synagogue twice a year. And so why would Judaism even be a part? That's not my tribe. My tribe is. And so I think that's interesting. And I also think it's interesting that so many people have many different tribes. Someone might say, you know what? There's people who I associate with when I go bowling or when I play pickleball or when I go play basketball. And our political ideologies mean nothing when we're playing that game, right? And there's people who I do Jewish learning with. And our sports orientation means nothing when I do Jewish learning with you. And then there's people who I want to discuss politics in the world with. And, you know, your religious orientation means nothing to me. And so there's so many different identities and tribes and groups of how we can affiliate in the world. And I do know some people who have kind of won, but I think that it is helpful to see that most of us are not post-tribal, like you said. Tribalism in its negative sense, I imagine we go beyond some of what Gary was calling kind of a racist orientation of a tribalism, but another type of just having affinity groups that we feel are our people, right? If we ask ourselves, who are my people in the world? And, you know, and there's so many different social, political, moral, orientations around that. So anyway, Sarah, thanks, Sarah. So I invite folks to write in the chat, but we maybe have time for one more person if they want to share. Steve, oh, good. Steve, hop in there.
I have loved today. It's awesome. Thank you, everybody. A person of few words, and I've always had trouble speaking in public. I've always valued or tried to identify people by what they do. That to me is preeminent. That's number one. And number two, I'm seeing in my kids a moving to a lack of identity, kind of what you can't judge a person by pickleball and religion. It's pickleball or religion. I had a talk with my daughter and we agreed about something adamantly. And then she asked me a question about politics, and I had a different opinion than she did. And she said, oh, my God, Dad, how could you? We just were agreeing on this, and now we're not agreeing on that. I thought we were people of the same skin. I think people, I noticed a greater number of my friends are now independent politically. They didn't vote yesterday, and I just sense that there is less unanimity, more individual thinking, and more you are what you do and not what you say. And I'm kind of delighted by that.
Right. Yeah, Steve, thank you for that. That's so interesting. And I think that in a whole lot of ways, we're going to see more of that. People who check the religion box, none, or can't easily just check off a religious belief or a political party or even a race. People who are brown, who are married to someone black, people who are white, who are married to someone Korean, right? That people can't just say, oh, I'm Caucasian or I'm Asian or I'm black. Like we're many things. And our identities are multiple and our viewpoints are multiple. And there are people who are kind of missing that world. They long for that world where America was greater because there was a unanimity. There was a common way of thinking about the world. But I think that those days are changing fast. And I think that there's so much to say about that. But anyways, I appreciate you saying that. And I do hope that that's part of what we all as Jewish philosophers, which you all are, after your certificate of completion of this philosophy course, you are now titled a Jewish philosopher. that each of us can play that role of not just, affirming simplicities, but asking respectfully and gently more questions, asking more questions of curiosity about how people think about the world and why they think about it that way, and asking ourselves those questions. And to conclude, I just want to apologize if in any time during the session, this series, I offended anyone, because this is all heavy stuff. I mean, we're talking about gender and race and wealth and religion and God. And it's so easy session for me to have offended someone by by supporting a philosopher's ideas that may have felt distasteful. And so I apologize for that. I also apologize if I got anything wrong, because I'm sure I did, because these philosophers are so complicated and I'm not an expert in any single one of them. I've just kind of read a bunch of them and think about them. And I'm sure I got mischaracterized many of their views. And so I apologize if I, you know, to them, to their graves, and to all of you if I did that. And I apologize to those who didn't get included in the 45, who deserve to be in there, who should have been in here. But I really enjoyed this with you all. And I've always wanted to do this. And I have toyed with, I don't want to go too far with spilling the beans, but one of the future ideas I've had has been 40 of the greatest psychological theories that have changed the world. That psychologists in modernity have offered various theories of how the human mind works. And I thought we could explore some of those psychological theories. There's many other competing ideas, but if that's of interest, let me know. Or if you have other ideas, please let me know, because I love being with you all each week. It's honestly, it's the highlight of my work is being in this idea sharing space with such a thoughtful, respectful group who constantly is affirming each other's ideas, even when there's disagreements. And I'm sure at some point someone's been offended by someone, but I think by and large, it has been a group that has been so sensitive to each other. And so thank you for that. And I wish you all many blessings. And I hope to see you next week if you're free.